mastering your emotions so you can be a safe space for the feminine is actually, to me, the art of masculinity.
So I would think it means two things to me. One, it's always like in the eye of the beholder. So realize that it's okay to have a different view than somebody else. Two, it's always being created and recreated.
I think it means an openness to growth, an openness to learning, an openness to looking at what is masculinity to me and having curiosity about what parts are serving me and what parts maybe aren't serving me so well anymore.
And so the art of masculinity is truly that. If you can master being a lion and a lamb, you've mastered masculinity.
The art of masculinity to me means knowing how to gracefully dance between both the feminine flow and the structure of the masculine.
This is The Art of Masculinity with your host, Johnny L. Sasser.
Hey everyone, today's guest is Will Rezin. He is a mystic, philosopher, somatic coach and trainer, and trauma integration specialist who guides individuals on the often mystical and winding journey of waking up to their own aliveness. Will integrates 21 years of inner work, esoteric inquiry, and cultural research with 13 years of professional experience in the healing arts. Everything Will does supports his personal mission to end human suffering and his professional mission to bring trauma-informed care into the mainstream so that it can be available to everyone who needs it without stigma or exclusion. This was such a powerful episode with Will because I was learning a lot from him as he dives into some of these things that help heal trauma, help us work through trauma and come to terms with it, and then move on in our lives and our own purpose and passion. So I know you guys will enjoy this episode as much as I did hanging out with Will. He's an amazing human being, and he's got some really cool things on the horizon. So stay tuned till the end and listen to what he has on the books. All right, guys, have an enjoyable episode, and I'll see you guys around the corner. All right, everyone. Welcome back to The Art of Masculinity. Today, my guest is Will Rezin. How's it going, brother?
Oh, man. Johnny, it's going great. Thanks for having me here.
I'm really excited to have this episode with you. I had the fortunate experience of one of my favorite podcasts is Wellness Force, now changed to, Josh is going to kill me. What did he? It's a Wellness and something else. I'll have to get back to that. Josh is going to kill me for this, but my good friend host Josh, he just changed it. So it's
Wellness
me
and
off.
Wisdom.
But there we go. Wellness and wisdom. Wellness and wisdom. There we go. Josh, you were on the show with Josh and it was an absolutely epic episode, really informational, so much to dive into. And I'm excited to open up this box with you here on The Art of Masculinity.
Likewise, brother. I'm excited to be here with you.
Well, awesome, man. I want to get you into the manly round. It's just a few quick questions to ask you so the community can get to know you a little bit, maybe differently from how other people know you. You ready for it, brother?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right. Your first question is, what is your spirit animal and why?
A big cat. Might be a tiger. I had recurring dreams as a child about Bengal tigers, the white ones specifically. And I would go to sleep at night praying to the genie, to God, but praying. I was 3 years old. I thought it was more like you ask for what you want and you get it kind of thing. And I'd go to sleep imagining this tiger. And in my sleep, I would be with a tiger, I'd be riding a tiger, I'd be running alongside a tiger, and then I'd be running so fast that I needed to use my hands to move myself. And then I'd be running, and then I would be the tiger. And I'd be seeing the world through the eyes of the tiger, and I'd be pulling myself forward with my hands. I was just running so fast and needed my hands. I needed to be on all fours to be running. And I've had this recurring dream most of my life, off and on, depending on my life, but it's almost like I'm flying, but I'm not flying. I'm using my hands, but I'm pulling the ground, or I'm pulling myself. It kind of feels like I'm pulling the ground, and I'm smelling my surroundings differently. And So a large cat of some kind.
That's amazing. That's probably the best explanation. Plus it's like really, that's a really vivid memory. Like that's really cool that you have such a tangible experience with it as well.
Yeah. And I'd say, you know, to extrapolate outward from there, while there's this association that I have with being a child, cats are, they're really smart. Not only are they smart, they're agile. Their intelligence works for them. They stalk and they hunt their prey. They can be smooth and mysterious, but also ferocious. They can be tempered, very tempered, but they can also access that primal energy when they need to. And in many ways, my personality is very much like that. I'm pretty soft and smooth and docile most of the time, but I have the depth and the range to be able to access that intensity when I need it, much like a cat would.
Mm, that's awesome. And it's so great to like see that. I hear you speak and I've listened to like your podcast with Josh. And I can see that kind of cerebral thought process and your speech patterns and how you really address a question and things like that. But you definitely have that. You have that underlying side of ferocity, especially when you're speaking about something that you're passionate about too. You carry that. So it's really interesting.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool too. The jaguar actually only, when it hunts, it only makes 2 footprints. That's, I don't know if cool. A lot of people know that. Yeah.
I didn't know
it
that.
Only makes 2 paw prints.
Those are, they're incredible creatures. I spent some time living in Peru, and there was a night where we heard the sound of a jaguar, and it's a really interesting sound. There's it's like a growl sort of, but not like a large cat.
Yeah. My wife and I spend a lot of time in Costa Rica, and they're there, and I'm like, man, I don't know if I ever want to like roll up on this thing or be out in the jungle when this thing comes around.
No thanks. Oh,
yeah. Beautiful, beautiful, but no thanks. All right. Your next question is, what song, whenever you hear it, no matter where you are in the world, it doesn't matter if there's a million people surrounding you, what's a song that you absolutely have to start singing along with?
Ooh. Interesting. My relationship with music is different than most, I think, because I've played music the majority of my life. And I don't connect with lyrics quite the same way as I connect with the melodies of songs.
Okay.
So let's see.
What would
I have to start?
Maybe what's a melody you'd have to start humming along with? Maybe a melody that comes out and you have to start singing, humming with.
Yeah. Well, when you were asking the question, the first thing that came to mind was Moonlight Sonata. That's a song.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I know. Funny that that's the thing that came up. But that's a song that when I hear it, I'm just touched. And it moves me in a really special way. But sing along with. Yeah, I don't know. Nothing comes to mind.
That's okay, man. I love it. I love that you have that like awareness of what's the some people like. I'm just starting to learn to play the guitar. And every time I start playing, like my teacher had me like kind of strumming with the beat, right? You're supposed to strum with basically the drum holds the beat, but I always want to strum with the lyrics. I just always want to strum with the lyrics.
Yeah.
Anyways. So very interesting now that I know a little bit more about music, just a little bit, not a ton. All right. Your last question is, if you could pull a prank on any well-known person, so you can time travel, right? Mm-hmm. And so somebody that we would all potentially know who this person is, who would you pull a prank on?
If I could prank somebody, who would it be? I would have to say probably, maybe Alan Watts.
That would be pretty fun.
He's a trickster already anyway.
Yeah, he's goofy, man. I like his stuff. Yeah,
That's pretty good. I love that. Well, you did a good job. That was good. Not too hard.
No.
People get to know you a little differently. Mm-hmm. So I want to dive into this stuff. A lot of your work is around trauma and, you know, how we actually kind of a lack of address to trauma in our world today. But you're also this mystic and philosopher and somatic coach and trainer. And I just want to dive into a little bit of what brought you on this path.
Yeah. Well, I think probably as we hear with a lot of people, it was my own journey. I can say in retrospect, I've always been fascinated with humans or with our history, with myth, mm-hmm. with culture, with mystic teachings. And that fascination extends to the human mind, the human body, us in general. And so when I look back over my life, I can see ways that my interests were shaped by this fascination that I've had. Now that fascination, if we pair that with some of the real range of experience that I've had in life, I think what happens is those two come together and we see me just fascinated with us as humans. What makes us do what we do? What makes me think the way I think? What makes me behave the way I behave? And that's turned into like, I want to say almost an obsession, but it's not an obsession in a negative sense, like a passion, a drive towards understanding how behavior is created and how it's augmented and changed. But definitely my lived experience. I mean, I traveled barefoot for almost 2 years. I've extensively experimented with psychedelics. I lived in a boys' camp for almost a whole year. I lived in the woods during 6 months of that time, isolated from the rest of the kids. I told a little bit of that story on a podcast, on Cal Callahan's podcast, The Great Unlearn. And yeah. Some of these experiences shaped my, it gave me time for self-reflection, and they forced me to mature in a way that I might not have otherwise. They also gave me a deeper understanding of how other people behave under stress, how I behave under stress. I've survived on as little as $3 to $5 a week, and I've made, $30,000-$40,000 in a week. There's this whole range of experience that I've had in my life, and that range has lent itself towards to deepening my fascination and my understanding of humans. So trauma specifically was a byproduct of my exploration of, I guess we could say consciousness, Johnny. It began as me running away from my feelings. It began as me looking for some way of turning off the pain that I was experiencing after living through an assortment of difficult experiences during my teenage years. I turned towards psychedelics and drugs and alcohol. I mean, we could say, but anything that would help to soften my experience of what was going on inside and help me to, I'll put it in air quotes here, connect to feeling something good. And that led to an exploration of consciousness, exploring meditation, exploring mysticism, exploring various forms of myth and culture, kind of like what Joseph Campbell might have done. Not quite as studious or as academically focused as his work was, but definitely an interest in the more ancient and esoteric arts and cultures. And that led me towards studying energy healing and Reiki and apprenticing with some astrologers for a number of different years. And through that, I realized, I could probably do this professionally. I didn't have a map for it. And then I got a map for it when I started working with these mentors. I'm like, oh my God, I just did a retreat with them. They're mentoring me and how to become self-aware, so to speak. I wouldn't have used those words at the time, but I started to see that I could do what was most natural to me as a career. And that turned into exploring more deeply what makes us do what we do, our internal intrinsic motivation for our actions. And it started more as a mystical, like, how do I find my sense of my purpose, my soul's calling? How do I connect with ritual and the world and make meaning out of life? Studied Carl Jung's work a bit. And that led me towards, my mom's a psychotherapist. She went into that field later in life, but that led me towards things that were behavioral in nature, psychology, physiology. And she connected me with Peter Levine's work. And after living in Peru for almost a year, I came back to the States and started going through the somatic experiencing training. And that's where everything coalesced for me. It all came together into focus. And what Peter's done really beautifully is he's put language to the mystical, and he's measured it with science. And so whether we call it energy, whether we call it the chakra systems, or whether we call it the nervous system and, you know, a constellation of nerve endings, it doesn't really matter. We're still talking about the same thing that happens inside the human body. And that was the opening that I needed to begin to make sense for things to come into focus. And I realized that trauma is a word that we're using nowadays to describe that which prevents us from being alive or experiencing our aliveness. We're always alive, but that which prevents us from experiencing our aliveness is the living memory of the past that's still happening inside of us right now. And we can't distinguish right now from that memory when it's living inside of us. And it just seems to be a byproduct of how we're wired at the moment, how we've evolved, and how we've been conditioned through culture and religion and a variety of other different factors, family and stuff. And once I realized that, I'm like, oh, well, it all makes sense. But the way I describe trauma is very different than what, you know, the average person might think of when they think of trauma. They think of the trauma unit at the hospital. You get hit by something and they go and you stitch it up and that's that. But what we know is the body has a really beautiful memory system. It's not just in the brain. It's all over. It's a reflex. You were in the military, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you trained your reflexes to behave in a certain way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that would keep you alive. Those reflexes are necessary.
Yep.
Well, our organism it grows that way. So we have these reflexes and adaptations to stress. We can train some of those out of ourselves and others we can't. And so this interest that I have in this has really illuminated the way that most of us move through life without an awareness of these reflexes. And that augments our personality traits. It changes who we might partner with, the kinds of work that we might choose, the kinds of locations we might live in, and how we might behave in any given circumstance. Right? That living memory really dictates so much of us. And so when we're, you know, in my curiosity about, well, how do I help a person change their behavior? Right? Just asking that question, I'm like, well, here
Good
we go,
luck.
Rabbit hole. Right. There's the rabbit hole. Well, what's causing the behavior in the first place?
Yeah.
Long answer to your simple question.
I know. I love it, brother. This is where I think, like, this is where obviously the real fruitful parts of conversation happen, because there's so many things that we can all start to pull out of this. But one of the things I wanted to ask you was, you know, listening to you kind of extrapolate a lot of that and say, okay, are we misidentifying trauma today? Like, I feel like trauma is a big buzzword a lot in the self-development world. I feel like it's a lot when people are, you know, quote unquote coaches. Is trauma being misclassified? And if not, like, are we kind of really correct in our identification of trauma and how our brain, you know, creates this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in many ways it is misclassified and misunderstood. Part of one of the reasons why my ex-fiance Ariana and I created the training that we run together, we stayed business partners and we separated romantically last summer. But part of the reason that the two of us created this training that we did was to help people to understand what it actually is. Because once we started to understand it, we realized, oh, geez, we've had it all wrong. Trauma is not what happened to us. It's how our body responds to what happened to us. It's the living memory of what happened. It's why some people go to war and come back and seemingly unfazed, and others go to war and come back and they have PTSD or symptoms that are unexplainable, right? Physiological responses that just don't seem to go away. It's why somebody gets into a small fender bender, they get rear-ended and they're fine. There's nothing going on. And another person has that happen, and they're, you know, they spend the next 6 years trying to figure out what's going on with all these mysterious symptoms. There's each body is as unique as our fingerprints. And sometimes the memory of the, of that experience lives on inside of the body. And so that living memory, we're understanding it better with science. I mean, I say we, I'm not a part of the research. That's definitely not my thing, but at least I'm not a part of the research yet. You know, I won't be the one doing the researching, but that maybe we'll talk about that a little later on. But research is really pointing to the way that our nervous system, just one part of the whole of us, encodes stress in a really intelligent way to adapt to future occurrences of these things. And it also sometimes inhibits our natural response to stress. Mm-hmm. So there's a great video out there. Maybe we can link to it. I can drop you the link to the YouTube video of it.
Yeah.
With Peter Levine talking about stress physiology, and there's a video of a polar bear, and this polar bear is getting tagged to be studied. So this team has a helicopter and they're chasing the polar bear, and they tag it with the tranquilizer, and the polar bear goes down and it's breathing really heavily, and they get up to it and they tag it with the tag, and it starts to come out of the tranquilizing. The tranquilizer starts to wear off, and its legs start moving again like they were before, because it was running when it was tranquilized. So it's immobilized. So the body stops moving, but the processing is still happening inside, right? So the sensory input is still occurring. Mm. So when it starts to come out of that deep, frozen, immobilized state, its system goes back into these movements that it was making. So there's all this energy, the sympathetic energy that's stored in the system. So it's twitching, and it starts taking these really deep breaths, and it starts self-regulating. Right? So the system goes, okay, well, threat is diminishing. Let's calm down. Well, this is a sequence that often takes place in nature. It's a sequence that's often inhibited. It's prevented in us as humans. And I don't know exactly what causes us to prevent it. It's something that I'm very interested in learning about. But it's going to take years of study for us to figure out what it is that we do as humans that prevent us from responding more naturally to it. The signs of trauma only show up in domesticated creatures. We don't see it anywhere else in the animal world. So we don't see it in any animals in nature. But we do see it in animals who've been domesticated. Animals that are kept at zoos or domesticated animals like dogs and cats. So we can actually see these symptoms in them. And I suggest that we're passing our sickness on to them. And I really do think it's a sickness. Mm. It's something that prevents us from living. Most mystic traditions have this philosophy of coming into the present moment being the answer to something, right? Whatever the question is. I don't know what exactly the question is, but there's the answer. But it's about being fully present with ourselves, right? Being here in the moment. Yeah. And that is somehow this key to infinity, to nirvana, to something. Well, animals live fully in the present moment. Now, some of that is brain development related. And we can still access that state. And so it's interesting the way that our habituated behavior can train us away from what's most natural to our body. And
it seems like almost like a devolution, I would say, because we had that system, and then all of a sudden, like, I almost feel that we've pulled away from that and create, I mean, I almost would venture to say that a lot of what we classify as trauma today is self-made and manufactured by society. And there's really almost not as much stress on us as what it was back in the hunter-gatherer days. So it's like we've devolved in a way, right? Is that kind of...
In some ways, yeah. Well, there aren't, for a lot of us in the industrialized world, let's just say, those of us in the industrialized world, there aren't tigers in the trees, right? I don't have to worry about a bear or a mountain lion. I don't have to worry about an elk ramming me. You know, there are very few of those kinds of things, but my body still has this primitive system that hasn't caught up to the speed of evolution of technology. So I'm still getting the same kind of danger cues from my environment, even when the danger is not proportionate to the signaling that I'm getting, right, to the trigger. I think it's complex. I have ideas about it, but there's just not enough research on it for me to fully understand. A friend of mine and I created a foundation, and that's part of our mission, just to understand that. What is it?
Yeah.
What is it that prevents us?
Let's dive into that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so it's called the Truth Foundation. Uh-huh. And the Truth Foundation, its focus is to end trauma. And we believe that trauma is the biggest cause of our problems as a species. We believe that it's what leads to war. It's what leads to polluting our planet. It's what leads to difficulties in relationships. It's what leads to all of it, we believe. So our hypothesis that we're leading with is this is the greatest problem humanity's ever faced. It's the invisible threat because we're not sure where it came from. It's been a part of culture so long that it's embedded in all of our stories. The furthering of it is embedded in the way that we train our young. It's embedded in our religions. It's embedded in it's in everything. And what creates it, like it being normal, even in Buddhism, suffering is a fact of life. It's one of the Four Noble Truths, right? Suffering is. So we learn to come to terms with suffering. But I say, no, suffering's not inevitable. Pain's inevitable. Pain is inevitable. But suffering, that's the lingering of that pain. It doesn't have to linger on. I think it's been inevitable because we've not been a part of, we're not active participants in our process of evolution. And when I say evolution, I mean our process of change. The way that we adapt, we're not active participants in that. We're passive bystanders, so to speak. As an organism, we're adjusting and adapting, but it happens across time at such a rate that I couldn't study it across four generations. Not without looking back. I can't do it real time. So it's difficult for me to be an active participant in how that's taking place. And we don't have systems set up for us as a species that help us to monitor this and to do something about it. And that's where we come in. So our mission is to build that, put that into place. And that starts with research. So we're in the very beginning phases of putting things together so that we can start a round of research funding. And once that happens, we'll be hosting conversations and events and a variety of different things where we can bring together people to have this conversation. And we believe there have to be people from every culture on the planet that have to be involved in this because every culture on the planet has a different way of domesticating themselves. So
Go ahead.
I was going to say, as a white American man, I only have a real fraction of an understanding of what our process of domestication is like here in the United States. And you have a different understanding, although there may be overlaps. And so the size of the study is going to be enormous because we have to take into consideration every culture and all the different cultural norms that come along with those cultures and the history that comes along with that and so on.
It's really fascinating. And it's fascinating because you guys, that's a tall order. I mean, this is a tall order to really embark on. And when I look at this, I have to ask, cause this is one of the things that, especially going on the pod, you know, this podcast that I, you know, with men, because I was there, is like, how do we get men to even say first that they have trauma, right? Like, how do we get men to even say, oh yeah, yeah, I do. I got something I got to work on. I have these things that are affecting my life and giving me limitations. you know, how do we even do this? Like, what's something that we can even open the door for them with?
Yeah. You know, the place that I begin these days is with science. Here's how our body responds to stress. This is normal for every human being. It's not that we're weak. It's not that there's something wrong with us. It's that there's something right with us. And that something right also has a way of inhibiting our ability to be in the present moment, our ability to respond to things so we can become reactive. Every man knows what it's like to be reactive. Every man knows what it's like to hold back tears because it's not okay for us to show them. Every man in some way or another has been told and given the messaging that you got to be strong. You got to be tough. You got to hold it together. And that means don't be emotional. Well, us inhibiting our emotions, that energy goes somewhere. Something happens to that. Emotions are our limbic system. Our limbic system is our alert system. It's what mobilizes us when there's a threat. Relationship stress triggers a similar cascade of a response in the body as physiological stress. Right. So if there is an enemy, if I'm in a situation where there's a real physical threat to my life somewhere near me, my body's going to have this physiological response to mobilize me so that I can either get the fuck out of there, or I can protect myself, I can fight against it, or I can become completely immobilized so I don't experience the sensations of my own death. Well, relational stress sets off a similar cascade. When mom does not attend to me when I need food, my body goes into a state of shock. I cultivate coping mechanisms and strategies for getting my needs met. That's just a small little example of that. When that happens progressively across time and I'm not attended to, and this is just one example, my system learns across time that there's a threat. Now I have that active alarm system that's going off. And what that does is it taxes my body. My body's using extra resources to manage this threat that is invisible now. And so then I'm left with a lingering physiological response that just keeps playing out in my life. So where do we begin with men? We begin by explaining.
Yeah.
We begin by talking about it. Hey, this is a normal response. You're really stressed right now. You're shut down. Of course you are. Shut down because expressing yourself wasn't okay. It's not safe, quote unquote, right? I can't, if I express myself, something's going to happen. I'm going to be cast out of the tribe, you know, that's my belonging. If my belonging's threatened, my safety's threatened. If my safety's threatened, I might die. So what do? I respond to it. And then here we are in our little loops, right? Social, cultural loops. And our partner says something, we feel something, but we're men. We can't express that. Eventually we explode or we get sick.
Ooh, let's dive into that a little bit. I think that's something that I don't think a lot of men realize is that, yeah, there's the explosion part and there's the deterioration of relationships, right? That ends up being a byproduct of trauma in a lot of ways, but a lot of things that we don't, and I didn't realize this until I started my own self-development journey and started my own, you know, journey for actually looking into holistic versions of health and the impacts of our mind on our body. But let's dive into this a little bit. What is the impact physiologically to us?
Yeah, well, we can see it as, major illnesses, right? We see it with heart disease. We see it with early onset of strokes, or we can also see it with a small deterioration of our vitality. That low grade stress turns into less energy. Maybe our testosterone levels drop earlier in life, or maybe we're fatigued a lot. We have difficulty regulating our intestinal function instead of, you know, other things. We become sensitive to foods. But there's an assortment of different ways that this could show up. Right. Certain diseases may start to show up earlier. We might have cognitive decline. All sorts of different things, right? The aging process seems to be taking place earlier. Men in their 50s are falling apart as though they're in their 70s or their 80s, their bodies rather, right? And that is a byproduct of enormous amounts of internalized stress. So rather than me taking care of myself and doing something about it, that energy goes somewhere inward.
And so when guys start to harness this inward and they start to think about, okay, like, all right, well, I get it. Like maybe there's something here. How do we kind of, how do you guide them or how do you, what do you give them to locate maybe where, because I'm assuming, and I'll let you elaborate, is the focus on this is to also identify where this trauma started, right? And so
Not always, but again, what's happening right now in my life? Where are the points where there's things aren't going necessarily smoothly? Where are the roadblocks or where's the scratchiness? Instead of it being smooth. And we start there. Where are my triggers right now? And as I get to know where my triggers are right now, what that oftentimes leads to a memory. If I really truly explore whatever is happening in the present moment, it'll, with practice, I'll be able to associate that to, oh my God, this reminds me of that one time when. And once I connect with that one time when, then I start remembering that and I start feeling whatever that feeling was. I remember that one time my dad yelled at me and oh my God, he was yelling at me and it's now I'm angry all of a sudden. It's like, oh wow, why am I angry? Right. Oh, now I'm hurting. Right. Now I'm sad again. Oh, why? What's going on? There it is. It's living. It's alive still. Now my body can't distinguish between this present moment and that memory. And so what I need to do is I need to get into that memory, not in a way that makes it super big. Like it doesn't need to be really, really big and over the top. I don't need to yell and scream. Maybe I do need to yell and scream, but that's not the objective. Right? What needs to happen is the body needs to have a chance to process that so that it can integrate it. Once that's integrated, it's no longer using its like physiological resources to manage that. So the body's always managing things, attempting to keep itself at an equilibrium, a state of equilibrium, state of homeostasis. We call it, in the training that I run, we call it the natural self-righting mechanism that exists in our body. If I stand on one leg, all of my muscles are going to do everything they can to keep me upright. Every system in my body has that same intrinsic movement pattern or motivating pattern. Right? It's going to do everything it can to keep things in balance, even if that means it pulls a bunch of resources away from my liver so that it can make my heart function properly. Right? So when we start to get into these things, I know I'm kind of correlating the functioning of organs to emotions, but when we have this charged memory, there really is all that energy, the electrical impulse currents and whatnot inside of us. And our body's using a lot of energy to not experience that, even though it's still happening inside. And so there can be this little pop, so to speak, or a discharge of the energy, and it reintegrates into us. And then there's a relief on the other side of that. And sometimes what we see happen for people is that after they've integrated whatever the thing is, we don't need to know necessarily what it is, but once they integrate it, some of the symptoms that they were experiencing vanish. They just go away. Like, oh man, I'm not getting headaches anymore. I don't know what changed. Maybe it's my sleep. Maybe I'm not as stressed anymore. No, we integrated that thing. The headaches, maybe they were a lingering response to that. Maybe your body just doesn't have to work so hard anymore. So we begin by really getting a sense of what's present right now. What are my triggers right now? And then we work them. Well, when I'm triggered, what's going on inside? Can I get out of my mind into what's happening in my body? When I do, what happens? Can I be with myself? Or do I go back up into my mind? Do I need to do something else? Real training for us, man, is being with ourselves. Like, that's the real training. Can I be with myself when I'm triggered, when I'm angry, when I'm sad, when I'm frightened, instead of disconnecting myself from it, right? The whole concept of stoicism, I think, is really fascinating, and it's really misunderstood, right? People think it's this, like, I just don't feel my feelings.
So misunderstood.
I know. It's not what it is. It's, wow, I can identify my feelings, and I'm so trained at being with them that I can be with extraordinary amounts of emotion without responding or reacting, rather, through them. If we take apart that word too, reacting, we're reenacting, right? It's an action from the past, an action pattern from the past that we're replaying. But when we're responding, it's totally different. I can respond from this present moment.
Yeah. And it's, I have to ask, I want to take us back 1 second, is when you were talking about how that trauma can then be like popped and then be released. Or when we sit there and suppress that, you know, suppress that stress or those emotions from that situation, is this where you believe, or where people like to refer to trauma going into the subconscious? I hear a lot of people talk like that. Is that where this would get suppressed? And then maybe we feel a certain way when a situation happens and we're like, no clue. We're not even relating it to an old scenario. We're just like, why am I even feeling this?
That's exactly it. Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's a sure sign that there's some sort of living memory, right? The unconscious, I think of, Carl Jung kind of coined this term, the unconscious, like whatever happens below our perception. I think of that as the body's memory, right? So again, we have these reflexes, and what you were describing is almost like a reflexive response. Like, I'm in a situation and all of a sudden I'm triggered, and I don't know why the hell I'm triggered. Like, I don't know what it is about this. That's like, I'm just really fucking mad right now. Like, why the fuck did that person talk to me that way? Like, that is just wrong. Yeah. Right. But another person might have that happen to them and they're not bothered at all. They're like, I don't care. It didn't faze me at all. Right. And so we ask, why is that for that way for that person? Right. Well, now I'm reenacting something. I don't know what it is. Yeah. I can't identify it. I'm not aware enough of myself to be able to understand it. But as I become aware that that's happening, right, I can expand my awareness just a little bit to go, well, oh, this is happening. When else does this happen? What is it that's triggering? And maybe I just need to word vomit for a little while. Like, well, this person, blah, 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 blah. You know, like, I need to talk about what it is that they're doing that's making me feel this way. That's where we start. But eventually I start to understand that they're not doing anything to make me feel a certain way, right? The next step is understanding, oh, wow, this is something that's happening inside of me. They're just moving through the world. I'm flooded with these feelings. Is there a point that's familiar? What's familiar about these feelings? Huh. Oh my God, it's just like that time in 11th grade when so-and-so was such and such, and, you know, here we are. I remember it. This person is just like my father. And sometimes it's parents, but sometimes it's not, you know? And sometimes it's none of that, Johnny. Sometimes it's just like, I have no fucking clue. An example that one of the trainers that that trained me, one of my, I guess I'd call him a mentor at this point. An example that he uses when he talks about trauma is this great example. And I'll use it. His name is Burns Galloway. So I'm going to quote his story and use it for my own purposes. And it's not his personal story. It's just one that he made up for illustration. But it's this beautiful day, and I live downtown in whatever city we might want to be in. It doesn't really matter, but in a city, I live downtown. I come out of my apartment and it's gorgeous. And I look up and the sky's blue. It's clear. It's that perfect temperature between spring and summer, or summer and fall. Yeah. You know, like, everything's just beautiful outside. It's absolutely beautiful. Right. So I'm appreciating the weather. I step out onto the sidewalk, I'm smelling the air, and I'm turned to the left, and I'm looking, and then there's this flash of red from my right in my peripheral vision. I just see this flash of red, and I'm unconscious. And I wake up and I'm in the hospital. And it's been a week or it's been 2 weeks. I don't know what happened. I'm told that I was hit by a car. I'm going to be okay. I'm going to recover. But I was in a coma. I recover, seemingly okay. I go about my life. My body heals. I do a little bit of rehabilitation therapy. And then I'm back into the world. Except sometimes when I'm around certain people, and it's not the same people, I get really angry. I don't know why. I just get hit with these, like somebody will come into the room and I'm just enraged. They didn't do anything. They didn't say anything. I have no idea why I'm angry. And this keeps happening. And I start to think I'm going crazy. I don't know who to ask. So eventually I go to therapy for it, but the therapist is no help. I didn't have any bad things happen to me during childhood. You know, as far as I can tell, I had a relatively normal life. And what we have happening here is there's the memory of that experience. I was hit by a red truck. Every time somebody's wearing a red shirt, my body's survival response is triggered. So the mobilizing energy that would have been there to get me away from danger starts flooding my system. We call it anger. But it's just a limbic system response that would mobilize me to get away from danger. But because I couldn't turn and see it, because I had no time, all of those responses are thwarted. They're like, I couldn't enact them. So my body's stuck in this state and I'm unaware of it, right? Now that's trauma. It's the living memory, right? I may find myself in relationship dynamics where all of a sudden I'm just flooded with anger and I don't know why. My partner's done nothing and I need help. I'm like, I can't live this way. I've got almost no peripheral vision in my right side, you know? And when it's a really beautiful day, I get agitated. These are all little triggers, like body triggers that can, I mean, I'm just using one potential scenario and it's so complex.
Yeah.
It's not all like that, but that's one way that it could show up. I can't enjoy good days anymore because there's a cue, right? A sensory cue that my body gets that goes threat, alarm, danger, tiger, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a good example of it not being related to an actual dynamic with another human being. And the brilliance of somatic experiencing and what Peter Levine discovered in his exploration of working with people was that there is a way to help the body to process that so that it doesn't live on anymore. There's a way to free us from that so that we can regain our peripheral vision, so that we can be in relationship with people without getting triggered the same way, so that we can reclaim our humanity, so to speak.
That's beautiful, brother. I love this because there's a piece to this that I really is kind of like really touches my heart, my soul, because there are a lot of men who go overseas or are in these alpha jobs and we come back and we don't have any discernible trauma. There isn't a lot. We don't have night terrors like some other guys with PTSD. We don't have this high levels of anxiety in groups of people that often accommodates people from coming back from overseas. But I see these guys have very big struggles in their relationships.
Yeah.
And we don't associate with trauma, right? Like, you know, we're like, no, there's nothing there. But what you just explained really can help us come to terms that there could be, and it's triggered by small little things.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. There's some sort of memory. We need to have that. It's how we survive, but we don't want to get rid of that. If I'm in the kind of scenarios that, you or other brothers that you served with were going to be in. I need to have that kind of sensory, like, programming, so to speak, for my environment. I need to be able to rely on my body to be able to do that, because that's how I stay alive, right? So I don't want to get rid of that. And when I understand how it works, when I come home, I can start to understand, oh, that's why I'm triggered. Oh shit, there is something there inside me. I'm not sure what it is. Fuck, damn it. There's something there. How do I stop this? How do I come back to myself? Right? It's like, I really want to feel free from some of these things. And little by little, step by step, right? We work with somebody to help us to identify what those things are inside and help our bodies to let go of whatever that stress is. I mean, I call it stress, but whatever the patterns of tension are, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so with that, I know that you have something coming up pretty soon, some training that's coming up in, I believe it's May. And is this something that you're working with people around? Can you dive a little bit into that training and what's going to be involved in that for people?
Yeah. So we teach practitioners to use a trauma-informed approach when they're working with people. Now, whether that be doctors, whether that be nurses, whether that be educators, therapists, coaches, movement practitioners, any number of different people. We teach them to use this trauma-informed approach. And what that means is, how do I identify that a person's living with these, with this imprint? And 100% of us have this to some degree or another. It's just the nature of the way our bodies work right now. So how do I know when that's happening? And then how do I support a person when they're going through that? So we make this distinction between working with somebody who has, you know, trauma, and working on the trauma. So let's say I'm a trauma-informed practitioner and you come to me and we're maybe, say I'm a coach and I'm like, you're like, I want to grow my business, or I want this thing to be changing in my life, right? We're focused on this one particular goal. So maybe a strategic goal.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's more nuanced, right? We're redesigning your life in some way, shape, or form, right? While we're working together, I start to notice that every time we go to make this one growth change, or every time you go to expand just a little bit or go to do a thing, you get stuck. And over time, I start to identify that there's this lingering something where your trigger is really getting in the way of you taking some sort of action in your life. Let's just say it's in business. Let's just say you need to be visible on social media. We'll just use that as an example, right? And every time you go to do that, you get stuck. Well, that's a cue now. So when I'm trauma-informed, I'm starting to understand. And rather than me going and saying, well, let's work on exactly what that thing is and discover what that is, what I might do is give you tools to help you regulate your body's response to that stress. So I'm going to learn interventions. And what we teach is a variety of different interventions is what we call them, but different techniques that I could use with you to help you regulate your body so that when it comes time for you to do the thing, you're not experiencing as much stress. And then I'd be able to identify, ooh, I think this kind of practitioner would be really good for you to go to work with, and I'll help you build a team. So you can work with that practitioner on the thing that's triggering that. But while we're doing our work together, I can also help you to stay in a greater regulation, right? To be more regulated in your day-to-day life. Greater regulation means I have more capacity for thinking. When I have more capacity for thinking and decision-making, I'm not getting hijacked by my amygdala, so to speak. Right? Yeah. I know the military has all kinds of really great training to teach you to not be hijacked by your amygdala.
And, very true.
and then when we come back to society, well, some of that doesn't stick in the same way, right? So we learn new techniques, right? Different set of circumstances.
Right. Yep.
Right. So absolutely. There are other techniques that we teach that are body-based techniques. And they work on our automatic responses to stress. A perfect example of this would be something like, even right now, I don't know what your environment looks like, but anyone that's listening, and you and I can do this together, if we just pause for a moment, let's just say we're stressed right now. If we pause for a moment and look around our space, right? So, and we want to engage our neck muscles. So I'm going to look around. If you want to look around too, just notice what we see. The first thing I notice is that I have a massive storm happening here right now.
Oh yeah.
It's raining incredibly hard. And there was lightning and thundering just a minute ago. So I'm noticing all the rain outside. And then I'm noticing my water next to me. I notice my bookshelf. So when we look around, you might actually be able to hear the rain. I don't know. When we look around, what we do is we give our animal a chance to orient to our space. I pick out a couple of objects or just notice where my attention is drawn. And if I name them out loud, I'm now connecting that with my prefrontal cortex. So I'm putting language to it. Oftentimes I yawn when I look around, especially if I've been staring at a screen a lot, or I'll notice that I'll take a deeper breath. But we engage the neck muscles and that engages the vagus nerve a little bit. And so the science of this is that generally it works if I'm in a safe environment. If I just pause and we look around our room and we pick out a couple objects and we talk about them briefly, what happens is the system goes from a bit elevated or extremely elevated to less elevated or more relaxed. It just, the system automatically downregulates. So if I'm not in a threatening environment, when I orient myself to my environment, boom, my system calms down. And this is one of the many techniques that we teach, but it's so simple that most people just kind of write it off as, whatever. But in the moment, when we use it, when we're triggered, we're just like, holy fuck, that worked. Like, I don't feel triggered anymore. It's so simple. Just look around, orient ourselves to our environment. So it's one example, right? So we teach nervous system physiology. We teach polyvagal theory, the basics of it, which is, you know, understanding of the nervous system. We teach the basics of attachment theory, some psychological frameworks. We have a whole library of techniques and various different somatic or body-based practices that we teach. So it's 35 hours of training. 10 of those hours are recorded, pre-recorded content, and the rest is live. Is that right? Is it 10? Yeah, I think that's right. So we have 10 classes. No, 5 hours is pre-recorded, 30 hours is live. There we go. So we just increased it because, we just increased it because we found that we had so much time that was being spent. The live classes are now 3 hours long. So it starts May 6th, and it goes for 3 months. The learning materials, the learning materials kind of follow along with the classes, and the classes are experiential. And so by the end of this, most practitioners know enough about the human body to be able to relate not only with themselves differently, but the people in their life differently. And we've had people that aren't practitioners come through, but we've designed this for specifically for practitioners. So when you're using whatever techniques or modalities that you use, here's how to enhance that by understanding the human body. And we blend in mysticism and things like that too.
Yeah. Well, I would hope so. Mysticism and philosophy, right? I love that. So if there's any practitioners out there listening now, this is a course that you guys should be jumping on, and it kicks off May 6th. Are you guys doors open right now, or is there a time? Okay. Doors open now. Perfect. Well, awesome. Everybody that's listening, go ahead, make sure you check out the show notes. We'll link to Will's website so you guys can go there and sign up and be part of that if you're a practitioner in that field.
Beautiful. Yeah. It's easy to remember, traumaandsomatics.com. It's we've made it as simple as we could.
I have trauma around remembering that. There you go, Will. Well, brother, it's been great having you on the show. It's flown by. You are a treasure trove of knowledge and obviously could have spoken for so much longer on all of this. Is there anything else that you have going on or any way we can support you more other than your May 6th offering? Is there something else that you have out there right now that we can tap into?
Right now, we don't actually have anything else going on, funny enough. We were going to do a workshop, a single day workshop, but we decided to wait until later in the year for that. And for myself personally, I'm so busy. I take on a couple of private clients a year, and with the training, my weeks are end up being pretty full. But if anybody wants to get on my waiting list, they're welcome to send me an email. They can find me on social media channels. I still answer all of my own correspondence. So it's will@willreason, R-E-Z-I-N.com, or @willreason on any of the social channels, and they can reach out to me there. I work with very few people every year, you know, 6 to 10 people a year, generally speaking. And so I have a nice long, it's a long journey. Usually there's a bit of a waiting list right now, probably 6 months out, but people want to get in there. I encourage them to.
Yeah, brother. Hey man, you are teaching something. You have a great presence about you and a great energy, and you're teaching something and supporting people to find themselves deeper. So, I mean, yeah, why wouldn't they be a wait list for it? By the way, I also just heard that thunder behind you. Yeah. That was crazy loud.
Yeah, there's we've got a tornado warning until 10 PM tonight.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. You're in Austin, right?
I am. Yeah. I'm excited. Maybe I'll get to see a tornado. I lived in the Midwest for a number of years, and it's been a long time since I've seen one.
Bro, that's not two things I think should be together. Excited to see a tornado when you potentially are in its path.
They bounce around all over the place. You know, when I lived out in Indiana, not to sidetrack us too far here, Johnny, when I lived out in Indiana, there were many days where it would storm for 10 hours. And the Midwest can be like that. And there was this one year where we had over 700 tornadoes or something like that in a month and a half, and in the area, in the state itself. And I chased one once, and it was thrilling and terrifying all at the same time. I was in an old car. It's a 1967 Oldsmobile Tornado. And that thing was heavy as a tank, And, we chased it, and we got to a point where it tore up the road and we couldn't keep chasing it.
Oh, wow. It reminds me of that movie Twister.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, I love it, brother. Well, thank you for being on the show. Thank you for dropping your wisdom. Before you get to head off to your nice stormy evening, I have one last question for you. And that is, what does the art of masculinity mean to you?
I was thinking about this morning when I woke up. I was laying in bed. You know, I think the art of masculinity every one of us is an expression of art, and as men we get an opportunity to do that in a really special way, and I think it's up to us at this point to redefine what that means. And so for me it means being an embodiment of my values, loving and caring for people, being firm with my boundaries, being connected to my emotions, being intentional with my actions, and taking care of those in my life and taking care of myself. Taking care of myself first so that I can be there for others. There's this gentle power is what I think of. Gentleness and kindness, but firmness and power as well.
Beautifully said, brother. Beautifully said. I love that. Well, thank you so much, Will. This has been a pleasure. And to everybody listening, as always, remember to drop the ego and stay humble. Until next time.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.